didn't have enough money to pursue the patent, because I think we could have gotten a basic patent on it. And Jim Herrick said it won't work. He republished an article in Applied Spectroscopy saying, I can prove mathematically that the circular internal reflection rod won't function. So it did function, because it worked for us, and my approach has always been what I call empirical optics. My son is a fundamentalist. He has to lay everything, do all the ray tracing and that sort of thing. My idea is you just throw some energy in at this side, and if it comes out on this side and you can get some reflection in between, it's going to work. You know, I don't quite know how the rays actually trace some way through it, but these things do work. And I've got one that I'll talk about later, which is the same kind of thing. But anyway, we decided to build a beverage analyzer, and it took us about more than 2 years to get one that really worked. We installed two or three at Pepsi plants, and they didn't function for various reasons. They coated, the crystals coated, and we had interference between CO2 and bricks and that sort of thing. And when we finally worked our way out of these problems, we went to Coca-Cola, and Pepsi had gotten rid of us by this time, and Coke accepted the product, and we eventually went back, and Pepsi did too. But in the next several years, maybe 5 years or so, we equipped most of the beverage lines in the world, the big ones. We probably put out close to 2,000 of these beverage analyzers, and I hit the age of 70, and my wife decided it was time for me to retire, and the company was going well. We're doing about $8 million in business, although it was in a somewhat of a slump because the beverage industry was down, and I had spent a lot of time trying to find other markets for the same basic instrument, and I decided that we should have somebody take over GAC, and I gave Don the opportunity. I'm not sure he really wanted the job, but anyway, I put him in charge, and it turned out to be a mistake because he was a top-notch engineer, but he's not a good manager, and he has no market sense. I kept telling him, you've got to find other markets for this technology, and he just wanted to design a new instrument. He spent all of his time doing that, and the company got into real financial problems. In the meantime, I decided to go off on my own again, and I took a filter instrument that we had partially designed at GAC, and the board of directors said, fine, if you want to go ahead and do something with it, you're going to have it, you know, we're not going to take it anywhere. So that formed the basis of the company that I now have, and we finally ended up selling GAC to OI, which is in Texas, and I'm going to come back to them in a little bit. But they took over GAC and moved the operation to College Station, Texas, and nobody went, and that's one of their problems. None of the key people went. And this is what happens when a big company buys a small company. They think they can move it somewhere and it's going to be intact, but if they don't get the people, they have nothing, you know? They have designs and a product, but they don't have the people who know how to make it cook. So anyway, Don has gone to work for Don Stain at Sensors. And Don, my son, is the guy who's designed the product that is going terrific for them now. It's a microscope FTIR, portable, that is good at measuring white powder. And boy, that's, you know, as soon as 7-Eleven came, an instrument that will identify a white powder. Is it sugar, salt, or is it anthrax, or is it a drug, you know, or whatever. So they're making these instruments as fast as they can, and it's a $70,000 or $80,000 instrument. And basically it was Don's design, so I'm very glad to see him in a position where he's doing the kind of job he knows how to do. Don went to Harvard, majored in economics, but took spectroscopy on the side, so that was his background. Anyway, that leads us to Brooks Enterprise, and our business started out we were trying to build a fat analyzer. We wanted to measure fat in the hamburger and that sort of thing using ATR, and it turned out not to be a good application. The main reason was that if you put hamburger on a plate and try to measure the fat content, you can measure the fat content because it comes out and sticks to the plate, but you can't pick up the protein, and it just was not a good application. But in the meantime, the EPA came along, and we worked with the EPA to try and develop a method of measuring oil and grease and total petroleum hydrocarbon, TPH and TOG. These are the things that you measure in water. And this traditionally had been done using a Myron analyzer and Freon as the solvent. You mix up Freon and water, and it extracts the hydrocarbon. And Freon is transparent in the CH region, so you can stick it in a cuvette and measure the hydrocarbon content. And at Woke Scientific, we developed a portable analyzer that did just this, and it's in use today in all the platforms in the Gulf of Mexico and that sort of thing. So the EPA approached us and said, can't you develop another sampling approach, because we have to do something to replace Freon. And we eventually came up with a horizontal ATR plate, and the solvent that they used is hexane, which works just as well as Freon to extract hydrocarbons from water. But you have to get rid of the hexane because it absorbs at the same, it's a hydrocarbon, it absorbs at the same wavelength that the oils that you're trying to reach. So by using this horizontal platform and putting a sample of hexane on top of it, letting it evaporate, we could then measure the residual hydrocarbon. And that's the procedure that's gradually taking over today, and we are beginning to sell fair quantities of these instruments to replace the old Wilks-Myron instruments that are out there, and people love them, but they don't make them anymore. Foxborough went out of the business, and they're getting corroded and so forth. So basically, that's one of the applications for this device. But recently, I have been interested in trying to make inline measurement. Everybody's looking for sensors today, you know, inline sensors of various types. Nobody has a good mid-infrared sensor. And in the mid-infrared, that's where the information is. So I've been working for the last 3 or 4 years and gradually moving toward the ability to put these little plugs in streams. It turns out that one of the big applications is carbon dioxide in water. Infrared is the only known method of measuring dissolved CO2 in situ without going through some kind of a mechanical extraction stage. And that was one of the real reasons that the GAC land systems, land meaning liquid analyzer, was so well received, because the competing technology is either refractive index or density. The problem is that a fluid has only one refractive index or one density, and yet carbon dioxide and sugar both contribute to the refractive index or to the density. So you have to have some other method of separating the two. And they have a pressure temperature method for measuring CO2 or a diaphragm method, and then they correct the refractive index and the density. Infrared has individual absorption bands. You measure absorption band for sugar, and you measure absorption band for CO2 on the same sample. So that was the principle of the GAC instrument, and I've been playing around with applying The GAC instrument requires that you take a sample off the line and pass it through an absorption cell, and then it goes back online. And this is always a problem because of contamination and that sort of thing. And the beer industry won't use that kind of instrument because they don't want to see microbes getting back into the process that can upset the whole situation. So I've been working on actually getting this in line. And it's the old story that new electronic devices become available mostly because of the communications field. You know, there's a tremendous explosion of microelectronics, and you can do things in small packages, and you can use these little chips to do things that it took vacuum tubes when I first started doing business, or transistors later on. But now it's these little microprocessors so we can build today and are going to be building inline infrared sensors. That, to me, that's the future of our business. The filter instruments are going very well. They're portable instruments. You can put them alongside a process, take a sample off and analyze it, that sort of thing. And they're an intermediate step. We take instead of taking an FTIR instrument out of the laboratory, out in the plant, you can't really do that because it won't operate in that environment. We can take a filter instrument that'll do the job that the FTIR instrument does. But the real ultimate step is to take it right onto the process mine itself. And I went to a meeting in Atlanta last week at InterBev, the beverage industry. And it turned out that at that meeting there are applications for CO2 analysis that I've known about for a long time, but they're really here today, and there isn't any other way of doing it except by infrared. This sensor is going into breweries, because in breweries there are at least five different places in the beer process where they need to monitor CO2. In the fermentation tank and in what they call the bright product tank, which is the finished beer, but it's created its own CO2, but they have to continually monitor the CO2 level. And when they package beer, they take the high gravity beer, which is 12% alcohol, and they blend it with carbonated water down to 3.2% alcohol, and that's beer. The reason it's 12% is that's as high as you can go in the alcoholic content without killing the microbes. Yeah. Same with wine. You get 12% wine and that sort of thing. But beer is blended down with carbonate, so they need to measure CO2 level in the carbonated water, CO2 level in the beer, and all over. There's nothing that'll do it for them today except take a sample out and do a pressure temperature test on it. But this device is going to do that. There are two other places where it's really going to, if we can get the cost down, all of these dispensers you see in McDonald's or in stopovers on the turnpike, you know, that where you go up and put some ice in them, the biggest problem is monitoring the CO2 level, because if the CO2 level drops, no matter how good the syrup is that they mix with the water, if the soda is flat, people don't like it, you know. So this market sits there. There are literally millions of these dispensers. I talked with the guys at the show, and they said, if you can build a CO2 sensor that we can plug right into our line, and you can produce it for under $1,000, you know, you got a market. And I know how to do it. That's what we're going to be moving toward. Another one. And I've known about this for a long time too, is that Coca-Cola has these little white trucks that say quality on them, and they go around and they check the beverage that's being dispensed from a McDonald's or a bar or whatever, and they desperately want a instrument they can stick into a glass of Coca-Cola that's been dispensed and measure the CO2 level. They don't care about the sugar level. They want to be sure that the CO2 level is right. And I talked to a guy yesterday, and they you're looking all over the world for an instrument. And I said, I know how to do this. You know, in fact, I have a patent on the design. So now I've got to figure out how to raise enough capital to do the design work and that sort of thing. But anyway, out of this show has come two very, very mass market type applications for infrared technology in measuring. Now, we can do other things. We can measure bricks. We can measure another big application that
bricks is the sugar.
Sugar.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it's what they call bricks in the. A big problem in hydraulic systems is water in hydraulic fluid, and we have been able to measure water down to a 100 to 1,000 parts per million level, 1/10% water, and that's. That's getting down in the range where they really want to do it. And this is a technique which it doesn't work optically. But what we need to get down to low concentrations is to have a longer path. That water is a strong absorber. We can't use a long path when we're measuring something in water, but if we're measuring water in a solvent or a fluid, like hydraulic fluid, it doesn't absorb infrared where water absorbs. And I figured out that if we took a saw and just put a saw cut through here, normally the beam goes from this surface to this surface to this surface, and it goes to a detector. But if we put a saw cut in here, we now have a transmission cell. I've expanded the path length, and my son has looked at it and said it's not going to work that optically, because you can't the rays aren't just going to get from here to here. Well, they do. They get across. One of the reasons is that when you dump this in a fluid, the index of refraction of the fluid is close to the index of refraction of the crystal itself, so that the reflection losses from surface to surface are much less. But anyway, I found that putting that simple saw cut in here gives me about 15 times increase in sensitivity, and we can now measure down in the 100 part per million level of water in hydraulic fluid. Well, it turns out that the European automobile market has been desperately looking for an inline sensor that will measure water in brake fluid, water in transmission fluid. The reason is that a little bit of water in the transmission fluid creates a very corrosive situation, because there are additives in the brake fluid. The water and the additives get together and they create acid, sulfuric acid or nitric acid. And especially if there are aluminum components in the stream, as there are, they get pitted, and it's a very bad situation. So anyway, here's a market that's sitting out there. We have the technology. Here's the market. How can we put this together and come up with a product cheap enough so that we can hit these two mass markets? One is the beverage industry, and the other is the automotive industry. Well, this is what business is, and this is what I've been doing forever, it seems. But it fascinates me that these applications are solvable, and now we have a relationship with PerkinElmer, and they're willing to develop these microelectronics, and they're really looking for mass markets. They have a Chinese production facility, and their attitude, if you can come up with something with a big enough market, we can really get the cost down, produce it in quantity. And anyway, this is where we're heading as my little company right now. I hope I can stay around long enough to get this off the ground, because to me this is the ultimate in infrared. You know, we start off with laboratory devices that only work in air-conditioned rooms and rock salt prisons and all that sort of thing, and way out here we have these little plugs that we can do the same thing with, and they're totally same technology but totally different approach. And anyway, that's where we are. So I think that's where we've reached my little company at this stage of its development. We have one other project that we're working on now. When Foxborough sold the Myron business to Thermo, Thermo decided to cancel out all of the ancillary products except for the big portable, semi-portable, variable wavelength microprocessed gas analyzer called the Sapphire. It's called the Myron Sapphire, which was developed at Foxborough, and it's a really good instrument. But it's in the $20,000 range, it weighs 50 pounds, and it's not all that portable. And the people who used to sell the Myron dedicated gas analyzers, the smaller ones, have come to us and said, we need these instruments, and they're not being made anymore, and we'll put up the money if you guys will develop, redevelop these instruments. So it's like reinventing the wheel. We're going back into the same market where Brooks Scientific was, but simply because Foxborough or Thermo has decided to abandon that market. And I have a contract with the British Navy to develop replacements for gas analyzers they have that monitor the air quality in submarines. And they can't buy them anymore from Foxborough, so they approached us. And so we're kind of reinventing the wheel. But that's where Brooks Enterprise is today. And we're back in the beverage business, we're back in the ambient air monitoring business, and we're looking at inline sensing and so forth. So that's us.
Are the sensors a continuation of the sort of reflectance technology?
Yes.
And are the gas, these are non-dispersive gas analyzers then, or
the selective wavelength? You know, that's a misnomer. Non-dispersive is
used dispersion
wrong. A non-dispersive instrument was developed by Luft in Germany, and it looks at all wavelengths at all the time, and it compares. You have two cells, one of which is full of what you want to measure, and it absorbs all the wavelengths that you want to measure, and the other is your sample cell, and then you compare the absorbance. That's a non-dispersive instrument, and they were made by Luft and Mind Safety Appliance. What we make are selective wavelength instruments. These are instruments that select a specific wavelength and measure that wavelength. So anyway, yes, these are selective wavelength instruments. They make use of folded path cells to get a long path length. That's that's the gas analyzer. Actually, it's one that we're going to buy from a company in the West Coast that's developed a nice little gas analyzer that has a folded, just a gas cell that has folded path in it, and we can put our electronics and detectors and so forth with it. But so, in a sense, we're going back and redoing what we once did, but we're doing it with modern microelectronics and microprocessors and that sort of thing, which didn't exist when we designed the Myron system. Anyway, that's Wilkes up to date. I don't know, I guess I left out some stuff, but anyway, you can ask questions and try to get back.
Should we run out and grab lunch?
Okay.
Yeah. Well, this was another instance of communication between DuPont and myself. I had a telephone call one day from a friend of mine at DuPont who said that they have 32 FTIR instruments by four different manufacturers in their organization, and the different makes couldn't talk to each other, which created problems when they're trying to transmit spectral data and that sort of thing. And this got me thinking, and I got in touch with a friend of mine at JCAMP who was interested in disseminating information of this sort, and they agreed to sponsor a committee to try to get a way to communicate among the various companies, and I was able to get representatives from each of the instrument manufacturers to attend a meeting at PITCON, and we decided that this was something that was needed, and we went to work. And through the efforts of Bob McDonald, who was a retired spectroscopist from General Electric, collectively we developed a program which is still being used today, which is called JCAMP DX, and it is a way that spectra can be digitized and distributed to any FTIR system and disseminated so that all of these different instruments can talk to each other today, and it's apparently it's still in use. So it's on the web, and a lot of the spectra that are available from NIST and some of the other organizations are in JCAMP DX format, so that they can be easily transmitted.
Computerized data systems first really get, when did computers really first get conjoined to IRs?
This came about because of the FTIR, the development of FTIR. You need a computer to convert an interferogram to a spectrum, and it really takes a computer program to be able to do that. And once you have a computer, of course you can do lots of other things with it, and that's how the infrared technology became totally computer-oriented. Mm-hmm. Once that occurred, then the various companies that supplied... Once computers became available, then the various companies that that sell spectra put them all on computers and so forth, so that you can easily download spectra today, and it makes it much more convenient to work in the infrared region. And the same is happening in mass spectroscopy also. All of their spectra are available computer-wise. And
Well, great. Well, maybe what we could turn now is to some of the questions that I wanted to... and this is going... So going way back again in time to when... to when you first joined PerkinElmer, and you mentioned that John White joined the firm the same day that you did, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about John White and his role in things at
Surely.
PerkinElmer.
John was a spectroscopist at Esso Research in Linden, New Jersey, which is now Exxon, but and he had become very much interested in infrared spectroscopy, and I'm not quite sure how he came about to be hired by Dick Perkin, but he did come from Esso and was very happy to make the transition and became a very important part of the company. He developed the so-called white cell, which was the first really long path absorption cell, 20 meter effective path length, and fitted into a Model 21, and you could really look at very low concentrations of gases with that sort of a cell. And among other things, he did the optics for the Model 21 and that sort of thing.
And when you came to PerkinElmer, if I was following correctly, there was sort of the optics group on Long Island what was the size of PE at the time and the different groups?
When I joined PerkinElmer, it had about 60 employees, and they were primarily opticians. Mm-hmm. The big activity of the company was making components for tank sites and that sort of thing. They did have an affiliation with a group on Long Island that was doing optical design of telescopes and so forth, I'm not sure, but they were, I think they were an independent group that was working mostly for PerkinElmer at that time, but then they merged into PerkinElmer. When it moved from Glenbrook, they had a relatively small plant in Glenbrook, Connecticut, to Norwalk, on the Norwalk-Wilton border. And that's when the Long Island